Hi, this is Simon Drew, and you're listening to the Walled Garden Podcast. This show belongs to the podcast network of the Walled Garden Philosophical Society, an international community of philosophers and seekers dedicated to the pursuit of truth, wisdom, virtue, and the divine, wherever they may be found. To find out more, go to thewalledgarden.com. But for now, let's caretake the gardens of our minds, one meaningful conversation at a time. Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of the Walled Garden Podcast. My name is Simon Drew, and today I'm finally going to start introducing all of you to just the phenomenal contributors, philosophers, who we now have working with us in the Walled Garden Philosophical Society. And one of those individuals is a man called David Alexander. So in order to introduce David, I'm probably going to repeat myself later on in the episode, but I met David a few months ago, and he's been a long-time listener of the Walled Garden / the Practical Stoic podcast. He's a practicing Stoic, and I could tell that from the start of meeting him. He's a very thoughtful individual, and we just shared so much commonality between us, especially in our shared purpose. And when I learned that David is a psychotherapist, you know, he's been very interested in things such as Norse mythology, in Jungian psychology, in Stoicism, the classical Greek Stoicism, you know, I just figured that we had so much commonality between our interests and purpose that I had to invite him to come along on this adventure in the Walled Garden with us. And so far, I've been getting to know David a lot better throughout the weeks, and he's such a beautiful individual, and I know that you guys are going to hear that in today's episode, because David is going to be, well, this is a recording of a meetup that David ran in the Walled Garden Philosophical Society a few weeks/months back, and the title of the meetup was Tribute to Albert Ellis, Stoicism and CBT. So obviously, being a psychotherapist, David has spent a lot of time looking into the works and theories of Albert Ellis, and that's what you're going to be getting today in this episode. You'll be getting the full meetup section where David is talking about Albert Ellis and how he was such an incredible influence on David's life. And so I know that this is going to find some common interest for all of you as well who are interested in Stoicism, because obviously Albert Ellis played a huge role in, I guess, popularizing the theories of Stoicism in the modern age through his theory of cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, I do quickly want to mention as well that David has a podcast with his friend Sean called Between Two Ravens. Now, this podcast is all about exploring Norse mythology. So fascinating, you know, these great ancient ideas. And so they explore these ideas together, and you can now find that podcast in the podcast network of the Walled Garden, and we're grateful to have it on board. So go and check that out if you're interested in finding more about David and his own philosophical explorations. So anyway, I'd like to dive into the episode, but before I do, I just want to mention the next two public events that we have coming up in the Walled Garden Philosophical Society. The next one is actually happening tomorrow, and it's going to be at 3 p.m. PST, that's California time. And surprise, surprise, it's actually going to be David Alexander running the meetup tomorrow, and we're really excited to hear from him. He's going to be talking about prosaké, stoic mindfulness. Right, so this is obviously going to be of interest to a lot of you who have been studying Stoicism. David's been very interested in this principle, this idea in Stoicism of prosaké, mindfulness. And so we're going to be discussing that tomorrow. So come along, ask questions. We'd love to see you there. It's completely free for the public to sign up. And you can go to, thewalledgarden.com/events, or you'll find the link in the show notes. The next one is happening the next day. No, actually, it's happening this Saturday at 5:30 p.m. And that's going to be with Judith Stove and myself. Judith is another contributor in the Walled Garden. And that's going to be a soul searching with Seneca meetup. We're going to be discussing Seneca's 41st letter on the God within us. So with all of that said, I think we're good to dive into the episode. I really hope you enjoy this. And if you're a member of the Walled Garden Philosophical Society, then you can see the entire recording of this meetup, including the Q&A section at the end. You can see that on the website. So without any further ado, I present to you one of our newest contributors in the Walled Garden, a founding contributor, and I'm honored to have him with us, David Alexander. To everybody who's here with us, and also to those who are listening on the podcast when this is released later, I met David only a few months ago, really. David actually was an early member of the Walled Garden Philosophical Society, and we got talking, and I noticed, oh gosh, okay, well, David has a podcast that he's doing with Sean, as we've just mentioned, called Between Two Ravens, which is all about Norse mythology. And so I had to listen to their stuff, and I thought, you know, what I really love is that these two guys are just getting together and discussing something that is so cool and so interesting, because they're extremely passionate about it. And everybody knows that I love seeing people just going out there and exploring things that they're passionate about, especially when it comes to philosophy and mythology and all this sort of stuff. And so it was great to see that, and we got talking even more, and I just really came to like David, and I thought he would make an excellent addition to what we're doing here at the Walled Garden, and especially his knowledge of psychology and of you know, all sorts of interesting Jungian ideas, and it just gets me very excited, this sort of stuff. So David, I'm honored to have you along with us, really, and I'm so excited to hear from you today, and thanks for putting in the effort, and thanks for being here.
Thank you, Simon. Yeah, and the Between Two Ravens, the Norse mythology, really has nothing to do with today, except that it is on the psychological significance of Norse mythology. I'm going to have to write a thing kind of connecting why, you know, philosophy and psychology and mythology, you know, if you want to know things about wisdom and philosophy, why Norse mythology, why our podcast is actually relevant. And so yeah. I've been writing philosophy, psychology things for the Walled Garden as well. And there's an article that goes with this little talk too, so you can, I think it might even be up. You can maybe follow along or view it later. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I'll go and get a link and I'll put it in the chat for everybody if they want to follow along. And I should mention that David's grove in the Walled Garden is called the Prosaké Project. And I think that our next series of meetups after this initial one will be focused on what each contributor is bringing to the Walled Garden in their particular groves. But for now, I'll just jump in, David, and maybe we'll have some question and answer at the end.
Yeah, no, I definitely want to have time for that. And that, Albert Ellis is somebody that's really inspired me, but especially preparing this, just realizing how inspirational he was, really, even just the field of psychology. So I wanted to open up reflecting on things that have been said in the previous meetups. We've had some really great meetups that we all come to the Walled Garden with different viewpoints. It's helpful to be able to follow different viewpoints to help ourselves and to help other people to really find what leads towards wisdom. There's no one true path, but finding as many different paths. I think that's what these meetups have been showing me. They've been really highlighting the role of literature and how that ties into philosophy, right? Following the author's perspective, the character's perspectives. And so my story with Albert Ellis, it really highlights this tension between modern Stoicism and traditional Stoicism. Something I've been following, was following the Practical Stoic podcast for a long time too, before it became the Walled Garden. And so the interesting question for me, right? Do we need the perspective of the divine to really understand virtue, the virtues in Stoic philosophy? Do we need that perspective of the divine to really understand ourselves? That's kind of a question I think that underlies everything I'll talk about here with Albert Ellis. But Albert Ellis certainly didn't think so, that the divine was relevant in any way. He was very unashamedly an atheist. He technically described himself as a probabilistic agnostic, which is that given what we know about science, what we can try to understand about God based on science, there's such a low probability that God exists that it's not worth his time. That's his way of looking at it. And so the question, right, that might put him at odds with the mission of the Walled Garden. The mission is dedicated to the pursuit of truth and wisdom and virtue and the divine, wherever they may be found. So can you find the divine from the atheist perspective? That's, you'll have to bear with me and see where we get at the end of the discussion today. So a little history about who is Albert Ellis. So he was born in 1913, raised in the Bronx, New York. His paternal grandparents were Jewish. And an interesting thing, I just, you know, preparing for this, learned that they had immigrated to the US from the Russian Empire. So I'm trying to figure out what the timeline would be related to Brandon's talk on Dostoevsky and what was going on, what kind of trauma was going on in the Russian Empire that they were fleeing from, right? Kind of that idea too, we talked about last week, intergenerational trauma, right? How might that impact who Albert Ellis was? And so I never knew that his parents divorced, his father often traveled for work, and his mom had really severe bipolar disorder. So I've never actually read a biography on Albert Ellis, just read a lot of his like self-help books and his theories on things, psychology. But just imagining maybe how much like shame and guilt was put on him by a parent, right? That's maybe the interesting information where he comes from. But one thing I did know about Ellis, one of the things I've always enjoyed, that he had really crippling social anxiety. And I was really impressed by this idea that he sort of learned to try to treat himself from his social anxiety as a young man, when he was 18 or around that age, that he studied psychology, he studied Stoic philosophy, and he had this idea that he would overcome his fear of speaking to women by going to Central Park one day and ask out the first 100 women that he saw, just walk up to every woman and ask them if they want to go on a date. And he was turned down 100 times. So that's certainly, you know, when I was younger, I used to laugh and be like, man, he's the man. He can just walk up to these women. Wow, he's really courageous, right? But now I look at it, I'm kind of horrified. Like, yeah, that's sexual harassment. That's, none of these ladies wanted that. And he's just walking up and, you know, for his own purposes, right? Trying to be less afraid, right? That it's not such a terrible thing. Nothing terrible happened to him. He doesn't have to be so afraid. So in any case, who was Albert Ellis? He was a psychologist and a psychotherapist. Something I was thinking that might be interesting for people is, what are the difference between all these terms? Once you're in this field of psychology, you get a lot of this lingo people maybe don't know. So a psychologist, well, first, a psychiatrist is somebody who has a medical degree and studies the mind and how to treat mental health. A psychologist is somebody who has a PhD, who studies psychology. They may or may not practice psychotherapy. So then a psychotherapist is someone who does therapy. Maybe they have a PhD, maybe they have an MD, maybe they have a master's degree, a different kind of levels. So Ellis had his PhD from Columbia University, and he was an early developer of cognitive behavior therapy. And so that it's kind of arguable where there's some things that were kind of behavioral therapies, maybe they used a little bit of this idea of cognitive therapy, but that really his approach was very revolutionary. And it was bringing in these philosophies of Stoicism that made his approach, which I'll describe in a little bit what his approach is. Some interesting quotes I found, that no individual, not even Freud himself, had a greater impact on modern psychotherapy. There was actually a survey that found that the most influential psychotherapists, number one is Carl Rogers, and he's known for this idea of unconditional positive regard. That actually, it's the idea that what really helps about counseling, what helps about therapy, is just having a person that talks to you and they unconditionally regard you as having worth, having value. And they listen to you, and maybe they sometimes reflect back, here's what I noticed, here's what it sounded like you're feeling. and that all the other therapy techniques, some might be more or less effective, but you always have that going on in therapy. That's kind of was Carl Rogers' contribution. And then Freud, Ellis really had some issues with Freud. He didn't like Freud. I might come back to that. I think most people have heard of Sigmund Freud. So, and Ellis founded the Albert Ellis Institute in New York City. If you're going to get trained in this rational emotive behavior therapy that he founded, that's where you would go. And he died in 2007. It's actually one of the books I'll mention. He kind of finished writing just before he died as well. So besides this, right, he founded cognitive behavior therapy, a huge approach of treating mental health and psychology. And he also had a passion for, besides helping people think rationally, his second passion was as a sexologist, that he was really interested in helping people to reduce the shame and guilt around sexuality. So he was actually seen as a founder of the American Sexual Revolution in the 1960s as well. He had a book, Sex Without Guilt, in 1958. And he had a lot of controversial positions. I'm not even going to go down that tangent today, but if you read about him and his views, certainly they were controversial then, and some of them I think would be now. But his main approach was this, yeah, what's healthy, what's normal, healthy human sexuality, right? And without shame. So what is this rational emotive behavior therapy? That was his term for it. But now it's kind of just been lumped into what we would call cognitive behavior therapy. He developed it in 1956. And another name that's really well known with CBT is Aaron Beck. He developed something that was called cognitive behavior therapy. And essentially the difference between them is that Ellis has a theory. He has the Stoic philosophy theory, and he's applying that and trying what are all the ways to apply Stoicism to an extent to treat mental health disorders. And then CBT is very eclectic. It's just whatever works, whatever scientifically you can show to work. So they included almost all of Ellis's stuff, and they include a lot more. It's the whole umbrella, CBT. Let's see. But also Ellis really was very passionate about proving that his therapy works, really doing a lot of experimental studies, things like that. He wanted to prove why it worked. And he really liked to speak in plain language. He didn't like Freud's idea of there's this unconscious, there's these irrational, psychosexual repressions from your childhood, these parent complexes. He was just like, none of that makes any sense. Let's just talk about your thoughts, talk about your feelings, talk about what's wrong with your behaviors, and let's just get you thinking more clearly. So he was very much kind of getting down to business, not wandering around in analysis for years, his stereotype of psychoanalysis. And so that Ellis, he gave credit to the Stoic philosophers. This is actually, I think, the first place I ever saw a quote from Marcus Aurelius when I read Ellis when I was, myself was probably about 17 or 18 years old. The quote that men are not disturbed by things, but by the views which they take of them. So that's a quote of Epictetus, also seen in Marcus Aurelius. That is the core of cognitive behavior therapy. That's, you know, all of modern, what a lot of psychotherapists do, comes from that idea, especially. If you're looking at the article, there's a little diagram. It'd be helpful if I could show anyone who's in the meetup, but it's his ABCDE model. So basically the ABC model of how do you change your emotions. If you have an emotion you want to change, you're anxious, you're depressed, how do you change that? So then his idea is that you're having an irrational belief. If you're feeling that upset about a thing, there's something you're looking at, not rationally. But you come into therapy and you know about the emotions that are bothering you, the behaviors. So that's the consequences in ABC. And the A is the activating event. So something happens, the activating event, and you know the consequence. You know it really bothers you. You know it bothers you how you behave. But what is the thought? What is the belief or the irrational belief going on in there? So you come in, you talk to Albert Ellis, and he tells you you're having an irrational belief. And then letter D is, let's dispute your belief. Let's look at that belief and challenge it. And if we can get you an effective new belief, now you'll be functioning better. Now you'll be feeling better. So I'll give an example of that in a moment. Let's see. The one thing to note is that's sort of, you know, that's kind of the origin of cognitive behavior therapy. And then they call this thing that, you know, came around later, the third wave of CBT, really bringing in the ideas of mindfulness, Eastern philosophies, acceptance. So some of those might be called like acceptance and commitment therapy, dialectical behavior therapy. It's all these acronyms that psychologists like. And then that Ellis was a very prolific author, that he has 70 publications on the Wikipedia page. I don't know if that's capturing everything. And he really liked to write for the general public. So his first presentation of this theory for the public was in 1961, A New Guide for Rational Living. And it's actually still quite interesting to read now and quite relevant. And one of my favorite books by him that I have right here, it's How to Stubbornly Refuse to Make Yourself Miserable About Anything, Yes, Anything. So I'm not sure how many words that is. It's a long title. And that is his sort of bibliotherapy. You read a book and you kind of, maybe you can do therapy on your own, right? Maybe you should go see a therapist, but certainly it's some good preparation. Make sure you can get the most out of therapy possible if you need it. Or if you're just, in his words, if you're just a little bit disturbed, maybe it's enough just to read that book and you'll sort yourself out. So some of his quotes, how did he write? He was a very funny writer. I sound funny talking about him. Oh, the book title again. Maybe Simon, if you could type that in there, somebody wanted to see. Yeah. Let's see. That the way he writes is very funny. So he says, here's a quote from him. You may spend so much time and energy being disturbed that you have little left to devote to solving your practical problems. Thus you may spend so much time whining about having to decide that you may never actually get around to making a decision. So he talks about, what are you doing when you read this book? Learning to recognize your dogmatic demands. So that's your shoulds, right? I should be better at this, right? I should be doing something else. And it's sort of the question, who says should, right? You're creating that for yourself, that you could word that a different way, right? Do I want to do it, right? Rather than I should do it, rather than I have to do it, do I want to? So here's another little example I like of how, what is it like to talk, go in and see, to talk to Albert Ellis. So his disputing your thoughts, right? He says, where is it written that my speech must come off marvelously? How would it be shameful if they laugh at me when I give it? So how do you dispute that? The answer is, it's not written anywhere except in the foolish script I write for myself. It'd be unfortunate if they laughed at me when I gave it, but only my speech would be bad. And I would not be bad, incompetent, or shameful as a person, or a no good Nick, as he liked to say. He very much is this comical, kindly grandfather kind of figure who I can just imagine being related to him. But and another one example is this idea is if you're, let's say you're going to Costco and you're buying a TV, but you're paralyzed by anxiety of, is this the right TV? Are they ripping me off? Could I get a better one on Amazon? If I order a better one on Amazon, is it going to break on the way there? And now I'm going to have more problems. So in any case, he says, must I really get the best TV for the money? I can't bear it if I get gypped, if I'm shown to be a fool by getting cheated, spending too much on a TV. But he says, no, clearly I don't have to get the best set for the money. I can end up with an inferior one. If I do get gypped, I can still get on a lot of pleasure out of the TV set. If I don't take the risk and buy one of the sets available, I'll never enjoy TV at all. So I better choose one. And just as I'm reading him, the feeling I get now as I look at him is this part, he's kind of like, stop feeling your feelings. You're being silly. You're being unreasonable. Just be more rational. And there is something about that that's not entirely helpful. So I'll come back to that idea. But for some people, maybe they need to hear this, his perspective. So a few other memorable lines, the tyranny of the shoulds, that so much, especially if it's shame, but a lot of negative emotions are coming from, you're telling yourself should, an unrealistic demand. And some other ways to kind of remember that is, what he would say is stop shoulding all over yourself. Stop masturbating all these musts. I must do this. I must do that. He says, let that go. And the phrase stinking thinking is actually his origin as well. So it's all these habits, patterns of unhelpful thinking that just make us feel miserable, make us less effective. As I was kind of saying earlier, that yeah, sometimes his perspective feels a little too harsh. I think maybe people in New York, maybe the East Coast is where I come from originally, really relate to some of that, right? I think maybe the Australians really enjoy his irony and his sarcasm. But for some people, you know, you've had a really hard life, things are not going well. And he's like, well, stop beating yourself up. Who says life should be better, right? Or easier, right? And that's not what people need sometimes, right? So that's one of my critiques of him, I suppose. So the second part, and this is maybe where Ellis did respond to that idea, kind of the third wave CBT of bringing in acceptance, not just focused on change, not just focused on stop thinking irrationally, but how do you accept? How do you accept yourself? So the book is called The Myth of Self-Esteem. And I really like this book because, well, again, it's a controversial idea, right? That a lot of teachers, a lot of parents, even a lot of therapists, maybe a lot of society tells you, you need healthy self-esteem. You need good self-esteem, right? But Well, but and then what's wrong with that, right? And how do you get the self-esteem, right? That you need a hobby, right? You need to play sports. You need to get a job. You need to be good at school. But what if you're not good at things? Then are you a failure, right? You couldn't do these things that are supposed to give you self-esteem. Well, are you a failure now? So Ellis's way of summarizing that is to say that society teaches us conditional self-esteem. You can have self-esteem. People will look at you well if you meet their conditions, right? And that maybe that's not fair, right? Maybe that's society setting unrealistic expectations, even besides the unrealistic expectations you set yourself. And so his phrase, his idea is unconditional self-acceptance, which the acronym is USA, makes it easy to remember. That unconditional self-acceptance means you have value just by virtue of being a human being. So Ellis, he argues from this atheist, humanistic perspective of how do you philosophically try to show that a human being has worth? From certain religious traditions, right? Christianity says that Jesus loves all his children, right? Or God loves all his children, and you have worth because of that. So God gives it to you. That's one approach, but Ellis doesn't care for that perspective. So in this book, actually, I don't have it with me, but the Myth of Self-Esteem, it's a really neat book. He goes through all these different philosophical perspectives. So Christianity, Buddhism, he looks at philosophers like Spinoza and Nietzsche and Kierkegaard and Sartre and Paul Tillich and Aaron Beck, the other CBT guy. He goes through all these things and says, what is their perspective on self-esteem or self-acceptance? Does it fit his view of unconditional self-acceptance? Where are they wrong? From his perspective, and he's quite confident in himself. He's going to tell them all when they're wrong or where they're wrong. For example, Christianity, right, says that everyone is acceptable. Everyone gets forgiveness. Everyone is loved. Yet also, if you don't act right, you're going to burn in hell. So that doesn't sound as much acceptance. Right? And then I just love this quote, man. I haven't read it for a long time, and then I looked at it. So he's talking about Nietzsche, and he says that that Nietzsche was a poet, a rabble-rouser, and a humorous attacker of his own views. So it's very hard to say exactly what any of his diatribes meant, but let's try anyways. And that's how he introduces his chapter on Nietzsche. So this unconditional self-acceptance sounds wonderful. You want people to have this. You want it for yourself. You want it for other people. Yet for some people, maybe it's very hard to find. This is, with major depression, feeling worthless. And how do you convince someone that they can give this to themselves, right? It's great if other people say they're acceptable, but how can they accept themselves if they are believing that they don't have it? It's very much kind of a philosophical or a spiritual question. Do you have worth? This is the book with the philosophers is called The Myth of Self-Esteem. And so this is kind of my summary of how Ellis argues for his position rationally. To argue that a person has worth or value. So it gives kind of an example. So what is the value of a human being, right? How would we go about answering that? Well, what's the value of anything? Does a hammer have value? Well, it has value to me insofar as it achieves its purpose. The purpose of a hammer is to take a nail, put it into something, put it into a wall, put it into a piece of wood. So it has value if it does this well. What's the purpose of a coffee mug? It's to hold liquid, maybe to keep it insulated well, keep it warm. But then is a coffee mug a good hammer? Maybe we could use it kind of, right? A little nail into drywall, you could use a coffee mug, but you do a little too much and maybe it'll shatter. But you're asking the wrong question, right? You're asking, it's a perfectly good mug, but you're asking it to be a hammer. So use that as an analogy. What is the purpose of a human being? Well, it differs for every person. Right? It depends on their strengths, their temperaments. It would be unfair if everyone had to meet the same universal purpose and one that they were not suited for. And then the question, what if you're not achieving your purpose? Well, you always have potential. Even the most damnable person, right, who spent their whole life just hurting other people, they could turn it all around in the end. They always have that possibility, that potential. Ellis's kind of wording, as long as a person keeps on being, there's the potential for them to figure it out, to pursue their purpose. So to summarize, as long as a person exists, they have the potential to achieve their purpose. And that gives a person value. You can accept yourself even if you have not yet changed your irrational, stinking thinking. That's one way to say that. So Israel usually would stop for questions, but I think maybe for the format with the podcast, I'll say a little more about how Ellis has inspired me and then we'll stop for questions. Does that seem good, Simon? So my history with it, right? Why does anybody study psychology, right? Why did Ellis start to study psychology? I first started reading Ellis at age 17. Actually, I was quite fortunate. I was in a advanced placement class, an AP class. So it's kind of like college level credit in your high school for a psychology class. And it was taught by a retired therapist, Mr. Bickle. I haven't talked to Mr. Bickle in a long time. I hope he's doing good. And this was the first place, right, when I read Epictetus, read Marcus Aurelius, was actually preparing to do a book report on that. I forget which one. I think it was probably the New Guide to Rational Living. Yeah. And then in 2020, when I started, something reminded me of Stoicism again. I read another quote, and it was remembering back that, you know, how much of my life has been shaped by the Stoicism that's hidden within CBT, led me to really studying Stoicism, listening to Stoic podcasts, reading Stoic books. So for myself, that I, you know, had a career going back and forth, always wanting to study things, you know, like engineering or something scientific, another thing that is rewarded with higher pay in our society, right? So it seems like that has value. Yet I was always pulled back to psychology. It's the thing that interests me. I always took it in the background as I tried to make other things in the sciences work. And so on a personal note, I grew up with a lot of anxiety, but I never had a word for it until reading Albert Ellis. You know, growing up as on the East Coast, it's in this idea, right, the Protestant work ethic, that it's shameful to have problems. It's shameful to have to ask for help. It's virtuous, and I would use that in quotes, right, to figure it out yourself. And that's kind of the culture, right? When that's the culture that's around you, it's hard to figure out what's going wrong, why everything kind of feels not quite right. So I also had a terrible fear of public speaking, and I was never quite as bold as Ellis. I never went out and asked out 100 women in one day, but I did use kind of his approach. It's called desensitizing yourself to the anxiety. So if you're afraid of getting in an elevator, you keep approaching an elevator, you keep getting in the elevator, and eventually you prove to yourself that nothing bad happened. You can keep doing it and keep doing it. It gets a little easier and a little easier. So what I started doing was making a point to look everybody in the eyes as I'd walk around at the university. I realized that I'd look down, I wouldn't really look at people. So I'd make a point to make direct eye contact with everybody, smile a little bit, see if some people would notice. Mostly they'd be uncomfortable, they'd look away. It's kind of a fun experiment I did for a couple of years, actually. And it's just kind of a fun anecdote. When I moved to New Mexico, I'd go out to the bars with my friends, and every single time, if there was a homeless guy out there asking for money, he'd come right up to me. And there'd be a bunch of people around. He wouldn't come up with them. He'd come straight up to me. We're trying to figure out, what is this about? Is it because I'm kind of tall, or what is this? But at some point, we finally sorted out, it's because I'd make eye contact with him. Everybody else would look away. And kind of an interesting side thought too is, I used to think that was kind of showing respect, right? His basic human dignity, but also that idea that when I look at him, that I'm seeing his shame. If he feels ashamed, if I keep that eye contact, I'm making him see it. Maybe that's uncomfortable. Maybe that's not right, right? So that idea, is it a good or a bad thing? Hard to say. Let's see. So that, you know, that CBT and this rational emotive behavior therapy, it's a great place to start to understand what psychotherapy is. Just the same way I think Stoicism is a great place to start to understand philosophy and wisdom. And then kind of it's the question, then where do you go from there as well? So in my career that I've very much trained in the CBT, but what I actually use now is more often a dialectical behavior therapy. It's this, the tension, the dialectic, which is very Socratic, philosophical. Between acceptance and change. What is needed? Is it change that's needed, or is it acceptance that's needed? And how do you balance that? And how do you learn to balance it for yourself? You don't need it from somebody else to decide for you. Yeah. So let me see. I got a thought. Maybe something I'll come back to. I'll see how much people have questions, talking a little bit just about kind of modern therapy and practice. But I just wanted to kind of jump to the conclusion here and then let people ask some questions. So back to the opening question, do we need the divine in Stoicism? So I think Ellis paints an atheistic path towards understanding the unconditional worth of a human being. Another way to say that is, what is it that's divine about a human being? Ellis always feared that taking religion seriously would lead to superstition and irrational thinking, and I'm curious how he would respond to this idea that really inspired me, that rationality is the divine spark. He would probably say, whatever you want to call it, I don't really, it's not worth my time. But to me, that's a really powerful statement that what is it about this rationality, this power that we have as humans, animals don't have. And then for myself, it was really studying Carl Jung that helped me to understand this idea that there's a rational perspective to make sense of the concepts of the psyche, of the soul, of the image of God, is Jung's word for it, that that their ideas, you can't observe them, you can't measure them scientifically, yet they're important. They're necessary for finding meaning, finding purpose. And so that's kind of where I find myself right now, where Albert Ellis has indirectly taken me. So Simon, I wanted to check back with you and then see if we have questions or comments or.
Okay, so there you have it, David Alexander on Albert Ellis and Stoicism and CBT. So I'm sure that from that meetup recording, you guys have got a sense of David's soul. He's a beautiful, quiet-spoken, thoughtful individual and somebody who we're just so grateful to have him along with us on this grand adventure that we're going on in the Walled Garden Philosophical Society. And as I mentioned earlier, if you go to thewalledgarden.com/events, you will find the next few events that we've got coming up in the Walled Garden. We'd love to see you there starting tomorrow at 3 p.m. PST California time. And that's going to be with David Alexander talking about Stoic mindfulness, proserche. We'd love to see you there, and you can register again via thewalledgarden.com/events. All right, I'll talk to you in the next episode. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Walled Garden Podcast. Remember that this show is a part of the podcast network of the Walled Garden Philosophical Society. If you consider yourself to be a seeker of understanding, of wisdom, a cultivator of virtue, then we want to learn and grow with you. Just head over to thewalledgarden.com to find out more. We'll see you there, and I'll talk to you in the next episode.